On this episode of Frisk, you'll hear
he gets on his knees. I can't believe I'm telling all this.
And you'll hear the first thing I'd ever said to this guy was like, can I get your number? He couldn't think of what to say at first, but then he said, oh, it's in Spanish. And me on the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. This is Risk. I'm Kevin Allison, and this is one of our conversation story episodes where someone tells me a story and we chat about it. We're calling this episode Lights Off, Pants Down. Today it's a story from David Zelnick that he told me about going to gay bars and clubs in New York in the early 90s, which is where and how he and I first met. I'll say more about David later, but don't miss his other phenomenal stories on his YouTube channel at David Zelnick 1946. Now, let's take a quick break and then we'll hear David's story. Now, here I am with David Zelnick with his story, Allowed to Look. Every now and then I have to remind people, hey, I'm just like a creative person. I like really don't know. Gay New York City in the 90s in the East Village when we did meet, right? Is that true?
Yeah. The sort of pre-story that I imagine is the setting for this story is Boiler Room. It's,
yeah,
you know, it's
yes.
My first time doing a story, and someone said it was great to hear a queer elder talk about New York in the 90s. And I was like, oh my God, I'm old.
An elder.
I know.
Sure. When people say something like that, I'm more grateful than not. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you and I are part of the same micro generation, too, that came to the city after the worst of the fear and the death of the AIDS crisis. And yet we were still inside of it so clearly, like it affected everything. And that was before the protease inhibitors. It was when death felt so certain, and it felt like it would be doubly embarrassing to contract HIV at that point, because it's like, well, now you know, and like if you get it, you did something wrong and you were stupid.
Absolutely.
You know, I hit puberty in 1983, so like that was, you know, being like, oh, I'm gay, and also the cover of Newsweek is like, gay plague. 50% of New York gays have HIV. And, you know, I moved here in 1989, and I worry almost about talking about it. But at the same time, it's so hard for younger people to... They know the facts of it, but just the emotional temperature of it, you know, the 3 a.m. calls of like, I had a paper cut and I hooked up with someone and am I going to die?
My God, yeah.
Just the relentlessness of the fear. 50% of the people you were cruising had it. And if you didn't do everything exactly right, you might get it too. It's a very, very different world.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
We were in the after times, you know, like the Cold War ended and we'd lived through Reagan Bush. And now it seems like the before times. And it's because there was no internet and there were no apps. And so you could be so alone then, you know, like you could wander the streets and no one would know where you were.
Yeah.
You could feel invisible. And when I tell people that, sometimes young people are like, oh my God, that sounds amazing. And I'm like, yeah, but you don't know how invisible you could feel. You could feel unseen. So often when I walk down the street, I would look down at my feet and I'd keep my body closed off. And you know, if you went to a bar, you couldn't look at your phone and like check out for a moment. You went to a bar and you were there. And if no one was looking at you, at least for me, I'll just speak to me. It was like, I am invisible. And this is one of the few spaces I can be in. And there was no safe space. You either left, and then what were you going to do? You're just going to go home. Or you stayed and hugged the wall and stared at people and hoped they would look back at you. Thinking back to this era, I was also thinking just how insecure I was. I feel like whatever cuteness resides inside me was just a mismatch for that era. You know, I was a 19-year-old who was losing my hair already, and I'm a hairy guy, and like, I don't feel socially awkward now very much, but at the time I did, and I would just go to these bars and I would drink and drink and drink.
Me too.
The weird thing I would do is I would start to like space out and watch other people hooking up, and I would try to practice not being jealous and practice grace. And then in my heart, I would like bless them. I'd be like,
oh, wow.
I celebrate you. I bless you. I'm sure I was looking at them in like a really creepy way. And in retrospect, I think I was probably trying to find a role for myself, like to insert myself inside the bar somehow. But I remember just trying to wish good on everyone. And when I did meet people, I would just like, I would fail completely at it. I was not very good at it. So the story really starts at a bar called Crowbar, which I don't know if you went to.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it is on their 1984 night. Those nights, I didn't get so drunk because there was so much joy in dancing.
Yeah.
And it felt like these songs that were from like 10 years earlier were impossibly ancient.
Yes.
And it felt like reclaiming in this group of gay men the like high school dances
totally.
I couldn't have gone to.
Yeah, I don't think we realized at that time that actually those songs from the 80s would just be around
forever.
Everywhere forever.
Right. I don't know your favorite songs, but for me, it was like if Gloria came on or the Kids in America, I would just be like insane. And so Rolling Rock in Hand, standing against the wall one night, I started to see all these really, really cute boys going through a curtain in the back and going through like a door frame or something. And I literally couldn't figure out what was happening. And then there was a moment that I realized, oh my God, there must be a back room here.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, a back room was like the most forbidden and fascinating thing I could ever imagine. Like, and so I, of course, had to go in. When I went in, I don't know what I was expecting. I thought sort of it would be like that, like the universe would change walking in, you know, and instead of just being like a space, it would be like
a realm.
A realm, yeah. Exactly. And not just like another room with a wall between it. You know, you could still hear 99 Luftballons. The first really unexpected thing that happened that night is, instead of feeling terrified, which I realized I did all the time back then, for the first time in a gay space, I felt very free and I felt very sexual. And it was because it didn't matter how I looked. And so
partly that was probably because, like, in a back room, the light is usually quite low.
Oh, yeah. I think they're called dark rooms in Europe. But, I remember, like, there was, like, red light and blue lights. I thought it would also just be, like, some weird mirror image of the entire bar, except opposite. But it's just, like, a warren of little rooms, and there's, like, one big room. And so I go against the wall there, and I just start feeling things for the first time in a gay space. I'm remembering, this is going to relate, I had a root canal once and I was in such pain and the dentist gave me Novocaine. And I was like, what did you give me? I feel amazing. And he's like, I didn't give you anything except I just numbed the pain. And when you numb the pain, a rush of euphoria is what replaces it. You know, he's like, I didn't give you anything to make you feel good. I just ended the pain. And so for me, I feel like that's what happened there.
Mm.
So I go up against the wall and then there's all these other people against the wall. And I start to realize you need very little data to make choices about who is attractive and who is not attractive, or who is attractive to me in a dark room. And there was a guy standing next to me, and he's a little taller than me. I'm a short guy. And I just saw his nose. He had a really big nose. And I was like, you know, I love a big nose. I was like, this is a very cute man. And he was like pressing slightly against me. And my whole body felt tingly. And then he reached and grabbed my hand. And he put my hand on his crotch. And his dick was hard. And I was like, oh, good, this erection is my ally here. Like, I can count on this. And then he turns to go in front of my body. And he starts kissing me. And that feels amazing. It feels like everything I had wanted and not been allowed to have in any gay space. And then he gets on his knees. I can't believe I'm telling all this.
No,
and,
this is amazing.
You know, he unbuckles my pants. My pants drop. I'm like, oh my God, is my wallet on the floor? Like, what's going to happen? Yeah. And I was like, am I going to be able to perform? Which I could, it turns out, in like a semi-public space. But then all of a sudden, my body starts freezing up again. And all of a sudden, all the fears of AIDS. And I'm like, wait, can people get AIDS from getting a blowjob? Like, am I at risky here? And he looks up and he's like, are you okay? And I'm like, I'm sorry, I think I'm messing this up. And he's like, no, it's okay, but are you okay? I'm like, I just don't know the etiquette here. And then someone next to me is like, shh. And I'm like, oh. I was like, oh my God, I'm totally messing up my first back room. And I realized like whispering is actually louder than talking. Like, and so he stands up again. He's like, do you want me to stop? I'm like, no, it felt really good, but I'm just scared. He's like, it's okay, you're gonna be fine. And he goes back down again. I freeze up, and he looks up at me and he's like, why are you frowning? And I'm like, it's a dark room, you can't see me frowning. He's like, I can see you frowning, you're frowning. I'm like,
oh my God,
I know. I'm like, I'm sorry. And so like he gets up, I pull my pants up, he's like, come on. And he takes my hand and we go out of the dark room. And then when I see him, he's like cute. Oh my God. He was like, to me, out of my league, that sort of like Greek guy, Jewish guy, Italian guy overlap with like sad eyes and just like, you know, and whatever people wore then, like a goatee and flannel. And
yeah.
Sometimes those bars, I feel like, look like islands of lost baseball players. Like everyone got a like used baseball jersey. I'm trying to remember what was playing. It was like the Safety Dance or something. And in my head, I'm like, you don't have to stay. I bless you. You can, like, I bless you. Thank you. Now that you've seen what I look like, it's going to be okay. But we started dancing and he's like, come on, let's go. And we walk back to his place in the East Village. And, you know, I start to ask where his family was from and try to impress him with like,
right.
And well, I'm just going to tell you a hookup story now. I feel like these might be universal,
sure.
But you know, he had a big penis, which is nice. Like I feel safe around one. Like I don't always know what to do with one, but you know, he tried to top me and I feel like the kids can't understand just how terrifying bottoming felt during the AIDS crisis. Like I'm sure other people did it. You know, I don't want to project onto everyone, but for me, it was not going to happen. We found other things to do. After we had done, I was like, did you really just hook up with me? Because we were like standing next to each other in the back room. And he was like, no, I saw you dancing and I followed you in here. And it was really sweet. And then he's like, take care of yourself, which was a lovely thing to hear. But it also sort of suggested to me like, oh, no, I'm never going to see him again. Like, this feels you know, live well, young man.
Yeah.
And I walked home. I lived like three blocks away. And as I walked home, I started looking around and I had this realization that somehow that encounter and that room where I was invisible made me feel able to be seen. But what it really did was gave me permission to look at others. Like I had made myself such the like, object of like, will people look at me? Will people not look at me? And starting that night, I remember having this like mantra in my head being like, I am allowed to look. I am allowed to look. And it's just very strange to me that the place I feared most and the terror of my body and of HIV and all of that in the early 90s, that it took going through that kind of space to make me feel seen and make me feel brave. That felt like a life-changing night. That felt like I started to walk around with my head up. It seems so basic, but I started to see that people did look at me, or, you know, not like everyone, mm-hmm. not like I walk down the street and, ooh, everyone's looking, but like enough people, like some people. Uh-huh. It made me feel inside the world of sex and sexuality in a way that I couldn't before then. I actually never went back to that back room. I don't know if it's a place in your life, but for me, it felt so magic, I almost didn't want to touch it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And since then, when I've been to spaces like that, like, you know, in Berlin, I've realized that, you know, I really lucked out because I like to talk. I like to ask people who they are. Like, I don't even need that much, but I need like a little. I need like slightly more than like the complete anonymity. But I also feel like there's something so beautiful about those spaces. And I think they're thought of as so seedy. And I actually think there's something very romantic about them. Mm-hmm. And the fact that desire is untethered from how you feel you look, that it sort of is launches into the space freely, there's something beautiful there. And there's something that I remember thinking all kinds of people could learn from in these spaces that were, to me, so demonized and so terrifying. So, yeah, that is my journey in a back room and how it changed me.
Hey, folks, another quick break, and then we'll hear the rest of David's story. Folks, this episode of Risk is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know, I know so many friends who struggle because they feel like other people have it all figured out as far as romance or their sex lives go, or have it all together, or got it all. Then I know so many other people who are deep in relationships and really feel like some problems in their relationships are intractable. So in February, you know, when it's Valentine's season, a lot of people get a little down in the dumps or a little anxious about all the roses and candies and flowers and whatnot. But the truth is, Everyone, me more than anyone maybe, is still learning, is still kind of figuring it out as we go. And therapy is a great way to work on that. BetterHelp therapists work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed. BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you so you can really lay out your therapy goals. And if you find that you're not happy with your match, you can switch to a different therapist at any time. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 6 million people globally, and an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. So, sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/risk. That's betterhelp.com/risk.
Go behind the scenes of one of TV's most watched true crime series with the 48 Hours Postmortem Podcast, where correspondents and producers take you inside each case. Every Monday, listen to a new episode of 48 Hours, and then join me, 48 Hours correspondent Anne Marie Green, every Tuesday for a new episode of Postmortem. Follow and listen to 48 Hours on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Gosh, I'll tell you, when I was growing up in Ohio, I was just always fantasizing about being able to be a part of some sort of gay sexual culture. I remember, I think I was 7 or 8 when Time Magazine had the cover that just said "The Homosexuals," and it was two male hands holding. I'll never forget, like, paging through that article, there was one picture from a gay bar in New York City with a go-go boy dancer, and you could see a lot of his butt, his bare butt in the picture, which was rather racy for Time Magazine in whatever, 1977 or 78, and me just being like, that's the city that I have to move to eventually, you know? So once I finally got to New York, I was very taken aback by how daunting. It was two things at once for me. Daunting to all of a sudden be competing with other males. I was used to being so afraid of competition among males. Everything from sports to board games. But now competing with other males for other males. And the weirdness of being like, okay, suddenly at 18, now I'm able to do all this. And we're all able to do all, and I'm in a culture where you're able to do all this.
And you don't know who to be jealous of, too. And do I want to be them? Do I want to sleep with them? Am I sad they don't want me? Am I sad? It's freaky, the layers of gay desire in that sense.
Oh, my God. It's funny that you mentioned the boiler room. I develop such mixed feelings. You know, like you said, it's a, just a tornado of feelings, because you would walk in the door and suddenly feel a sort of freedom. Suddenly feel like, oh, this is where I don't have to be masking a certain amount of masculinity. This is where I can feel free to explore different sides of my femininity and just, I don't know, experiment with being sexual in a public way or whatever. But at the same time, low self-esteem is just like another big theme in my life of, oh, I'm not enough. I'm not this, that, and the other. And so I had a shit ton of social anxiety. So in gay spaces. So I developed a reputation amongst my friends for Kevin will show up for about a half hour and be the life of the party. And then he will disappear. If there's a dark room, that's where he is.
Really?
If there's a sex club across the street, and in the boiler room had the sex club right across the street, then he'll just like head there.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. So I was usually only hanging out for like a half hour or whatever, and then heading to a space where you didn't have to talk, and you, and it was just our bodies, you know? One of the funniest things was in my 30s, I started going to this sex club up in Queens, and you were joking about the whole don't talk thing in those darkroom sorts of spaces. There was a fella that I would hook up with literally every time I went to this sex club in Queens, which was like once a week. On the weekends, I'd go there, and myself and this fella, who was a Latino guy. And after a while, I was like, this is a waste of money and travel time. Like, why don't I just give my number and we can just get together at one of our places? So, like, I don't know, it was probably the 15th time we'd hooked up at this sex club. And I whispered to him, I said the first thing I'd ever said to this guy. I was like, can I get your number? And he looked like a deer in the headlights.
Oh, he's probably
like,
married.
Oh my God, words have been exchanged here. And his response to me, he couldn't think of what to say at first, but then he said, oh, it's in Spanish.
Oh my God, that's amazing. Yeah, I felt like what I had to offer was my words. And so it was just such a surprise to feel my body unleashed that way. What I'm curious for you is, for me, the extra ingredient of the early 90s was the fear of HIV. And, you know, I also, I started, shortly after this happened, I started working for this fundraiser who's gay and was doing a lot of gay causes. So that's the first time I really met a lot of people with HIV. And I remember, you know, there's so many hot people. I actually remember thinking, you know, we were all going to get it. But then secretly under that, I thought, no, it's the hot ones who are going to get it. And it's a terrible thought, but I was like, I'm just not good looking enough to like have to worry, but like everyone hot is going to get it. And so there was this attraction to these guys who I'd meet who were amazing. And then my abject terror of contracting HIV, which I think at the time was both irrational and makes sense.
Oh, yeah.
And so they seemed like there was this weird sparkle around them because they were so brave to me and yet so doomed. Also just like hot, normal humans who I wanted to date. I remember I met a guy at a conference who told me he had AIDS and wanted to go on dates. And I sort of wanted to too, but he also had a cough and his nose was running all the time. And I just was terrified. I was just terrified.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, also
oh, yeah.
As a kid, in retrospect, I was like 23, I was 24 and dealing with so many other issues too. But did you have any of those fears? Did those spaces scare you the way they scared me?
One of the great mysteries of my life, especially in my 40s and 50s, like it's like I've just embraced, oh, you just have zero interest in fucking. But the big mystery is it nurture or nature?
Right.
Because when I was in the second grade, so about 8 years old, Eddie Murphy had come out with his comedy album.
Raw?
Yes, with the track Faggots on it, I think it was
yes.
called. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oof. And of course, that you know, that was fucking brutal, terribly homophobic. And as an eight-year-old, I was totally tracking. Wait a minute. He is wearing skin-tight
right.
red leather.
Right.
And like literally like kind of pushing his butt around on stage as he's doing this performance. And it's like, okay, what's really going on here? Anyway. Like I said, I was hypersexual from day one.
Right.
The woman next door had to tell my mom. Both our kids are in diapers, and your son is constantly trying to get my kid's diaper off. Yeah, yeah,
oh
yeah.
God.
Like it was, yeah, yeah, yeah. So anyway, I was just always obsessed with boys' butts and just like, you know, how I wanted to stick my face in there and stick my fingers in there and all this stuff. So when Eddie Murphy's Raw came out and everyone was talking about it on the playground in second grade, one fella said, oh, I'll tell you what those homosexuals do. I was like, oh, this will be fascinating because,
right.
you know, I'm so
news I can
I'm
use.
So interested in. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And he said, they stick their penises in each other's butts. And I remember at eight thinking, oh, like, they do? Maybe I don't belong. Like, that hasn't occurred to me as like the thing I want to do to the butt. So I was comfortable going into dark rooms and backroom sex clubs and all that and doing side stuff, doing,
right.
you know, rimming
right.
and yada, yada. There was one occasion when I was at one of those, it was one of those like buddy booth kinds of places
right.
where I don't know what happened. I don't think I was drunk or high or anything like that. I think it was like the middle of an afternoon. But then again, you know, in the 90s and my 20s, you know, I would have sex anywhere and everywhere. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I did fuck a guy. And I did fuck him without a condom briefly.
Right.
And I remember just being consumed by...
Right, the terror.
What the fuck did you just do? What sort of self-destructive thing was that? Where did your brain go? And I think that little experiment of fucking after all those years of just thinking, oh, that's okay, I don't need to do that. And then all of a sudden, like, being like, oh, I can do this.
Right.
I am doing this. Wait, what the fuck?
And did you enjoy it? Were you like, this is amazing? Or were you like...
I don't think I could completely enjoy it because a part of me was like, what is this self-destructive thing that's happening here? You know what
right.
I mean? Because of
right.
the lack of a condom. And that might have scared the bejesus out of me for a while and just kept me on the straight and narrow of avoiding fucking as well.
Right.
So I've always wondered if AIDS had not been such a big worry of ours at that time.
Right.
Might I have developed into more of a top? But, you know, it's fascinating. Like, I was talking to someone just yesterday about how it never ceases to amaze me that you hear people talking about their sexuality
right.
and romance. You always hear people putting things into boxes, or here is the story of how my sexuality works, or what I'm into, or
right.
yada, 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 right?
Are these men, though? or male identifying people?
Oh, no, I'm talking about literally everyone in the human race.
Oh, because I find men are so into more into boxes, or at least, you know.
Oh,
great.
Yeah. Well, I think I hear it from women or people assigned female at birth too. In my own life, I have found over and over, and it especially shocked me in my 40s. Mm-hmm. When you hit your 40s, you figure, okay, my sexual development is over. I've had all the kinds of romance and sex that are possible. And that was just like...
Not true.
Way, 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 way not true. In fact, in my 40s was when I first went to a kink camp, and all of a sudden this whole new, like, I ended up having to go to a sex therapist. I was so overwhelmed with being like, holy shit, I had no idea I would ever be into some of the things I'm now into. So I always try to remind myself, whatever story you have of this is how sex works, this is how men are, this is how women are, blah, 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 blah. There's always the chance that you could experiment, and because you're with a different person, or it's a different time in your life, or it's a slightly different way that you're doing it, that entirely new things could open up for you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I think of myself as like pretty gay.
Yeah.
And I was someone who at age 5 knew I was gay as well. And I did sleep with a woman twice in college. I loved it. I was like, this is crazy. You know, and it turns out what I really like are huge breasts. I had this out of town friend, Cockney guy, straight guy. He wanted to go to Private Eyes across the street,
mm-hmm. where women strip, right?
Yeah, women strip and give lap dances, and he kept buying me lap dances. So the first was this Czech woman, Slovak, I don't know, very small boobs. Did a dance. I wasn't getting hard, and I was like, apologize. I was like, I've been to Prague. I tried to like remember any Czech I knew, and I was like, I'm so sorry. You're doing a great dance. I'm a gay guy. That's why I'm not getting hard, but you're doing a great job.
Right.
And then
so funny.
I wanted her to feel good about herself.
Of course.
And then the next woman who gave me a lap dance, enormous breasts. This I'm obsessed with ethnicity, Italian woman. And I got so hard, and I was like, oh, I'm just like
a boobs guy.
I'm a boobs man. Who knew? I like big things. I'm greedy.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, it's just so, of course, Grindr changed everything.
Right.
One thing I'm extraordinarily grateful for is that there was this period after Grindr had been around for a few years where things became so binary. People got so stuck on labels.
Oh, right. Like a menu.
Yeah. Like, and it was really like it was millennials. It was millennials discovering, millennial gay guys discovering their sexuality and needing to define it somehow in a way that had to be very brief and clear and to the point, because it's on your Grindr profile, right? And so everyone was either 100% top or 100% bottom. And it started to be like, no, 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 you don't understand. The top is the man and the bottom is the woman. And just all this stuff where, and kink was just not.
Oh, yeah. And all the like, know this, know that is so gross.
Yes, yes, yes. People putting know this and know that on their profiles.
I love it when people say front of the line as though there's a line waiting.
Right. But no, I'm so thankful that, like, of course, there's enormous things that are wrong and fucked up in the whole hookup apps culture now. But at least there's been a backlash against all that.
Yeah,
there's much more there's inclusivity on Grindr toward people of different genders. There's total inclusivity of people who, like, are not interested in fucking and even like as like the dom daddy, it sounds like you and I are similar in wanting to check in all the time that the other person is okay.
Right.
And to be able to kind of own, oh yeah, 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 I'm the dom daddy who is very sweet, you know, and really ultimately wants to know that you're
right. Because now I fit into a category with my beard and like my body hair and my age. And it's like, I can be dominant, but, you know, you got to let me be like cute and sweet first.
Oh,
like,
totally.
Like the idea of walking in a room and being like, hey.
Yes. No, totally. Like, I think that it's exciting at this point in the evolution of sexual culture to more and more just own you know, what you really feel and what you're most interested in now. And the more you own it, the more I've found that you do find people who are like, oh yeah, I like that. You know, right. Like, so, you know, my grinder literally explains, I don't fuck with my dick.
Right.
And it's so funny because several years ago, especially in New York, people would insult me and belittle me for that. People would be like, oh, I prefer the real thing. And then I would like think of my fists and think, do you mean you can't handle this?
But, you know, what you're saying makes me think back to the world we came from, the East Village of the early 90s. The biggest difference to me now is that we live in a time of bounty. We live in a time of plenty. And when I look back, I feel like we lived in such scarcity then. Mm. At least that's how I remember it. I remember like how few chances you had or how few spaces you had. And it felt like if you met someone, you had to really make it work or try to make it work because you wouldn't know where the next person you could meet is. And now it just feels like it's a good thing, I think, now. It feels like there's a huge world out there and you can find your path. But there's also a little bit of a sense that people can be a little more disposable because there's always someone else. Like, I just remember being friends with people who I'd never be friends with. It was like we were gay. We saw each other at the bar and there were only 5 or 6 or 7 gay bars in the East Village. It's like it's not like it was such a huge ecosystem.
Oh, my gosh. And also, what we were just talking about, there wasn't this whole idea of you're either this or you're either at.
Right.
You met someone at the bar and then you kind of went home and started exploring what might work between the two of you, you know?
Right.
Like, in this time of bounty, like you say, on Grindr or whatever, like, I just got used to, like, oh, okay, this guy really loves butts but doesn't use his dick to fuck. Like, that just automatically canceled me out for a lot of people. Whereas back in the day, you'd go home with someone and be like, well, okay, let's just find out some things that might work for both of us. And of course, it didn't work all the time.
Because you weren't going to go out again to a bar.
Right, like, exactly,
like the only other option was, I guess, a party line, which I never did, where you watch Robin Bird. Like, it was you had made your choice. That was the person who was in your bed and you were gonna make it work or your night was over.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a better world now. You know, I'm very happy the young people are not scared of HIV and that it didn't warp their sexualities the way I really think it warped mine.
Oh, for sure. For sure. For sure. For sure.
I sometimes feel like, you know, like a tree grows around a rock or a fence and then you can't remove it or else the tree will fall. I feel like that's what the fear of AIDS was for my sexuality. Like it just grew up around it. For me, it will always be there as irrational or silly or useless. I'm not consciously afraid of it anymore. And yet there's just no way around it. There's no way around it for me.
Mm. You know, I also suspect that our generation missed out maybe a little bit more than most generations in younger learning from older, because the older gay men when we were in our 20s were less going out to bars and stuff. They were dealing with funerals. Yeah. I'm one of those people who, as an older guy, tends to be attracted to younger guys. And so that whole like age gap, you know, there's huge pluses and huge minuses to that whole phenomena too. But I'm thankful that in the gay world, we still have some acceptance of that and how, like, I mean, one of the things I love about the age gap is I feel like I have things that I can teach and that younger folks have stuff that they can, you know what I mean? Like
there's
a very interesting way of learning when you're with people of different generations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, not to over glamorize our community, but I do think there's more, and we still have problems, but there's more crossing of age or class even or career. Yeah.
Oh,
or
gosh.
Like,
oh, I was always thankful for that. I was always like, I used to say to my friends, oh, you go to the boiler room and you might be talking one moment to like a prince from Arabia.
Right.
And then the next moment talking to like a homeless guy who just took a bus here from Detroit. There was a real, and I think there still is, because now that I'm in Bangkok, you know, one of the first things you have to do is go get all your medical shit figured out.
Right.
And one of the things I've realized, and people have advised me on this, is, look, if worse comes to worse, just go to some of these LGBTQ clinics, because even if it's ADHD meds or whatever it is, like, we look out for one another, you know? Yeah. Yeah.
That's lovely. Yeah, definitely fascinating to revisit that earlier New York for me, and that earlier me, you know, like, I want to hug him and be like,
oh, totally.
I was like, it's going to be okay. Totally. And like, if I could have told him, like, you're going to meet so many hot people and you're going to have great sex and you're going to be loved. Like,
yes, absolutely.
And body hair won't be like stigmatized.
Right. Yeah. For me, it was the whole, I feel like I was always kind of a daddy trapped in a twink's body back then.
Right. I think we both fulfilled no fantasies of an early 20s gay guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh my gosh. Like, I remember when Facebook was becoming super popular and all of a sudden, you know, people were sharing photos from back in the day. And I started seeing these photos that some people had of me in my 20s. And I was like, wow, dude.
Right.
You spent your entire 20s just like, so upset about how ugly you were, and
poo. You look great,
ugly, right?
Oh, you can be told that so many times, but somewhere right now is a 23-year-old who hates himself herself,
and
they can't be told. You can't be convinced.
And the whole "I don't belong" thing. When I first did go to that kink camp in my 40s. I mean, the initial feeling was the same as going to a gay pride parade in 1988, where all of a sudden it was like, I remember we entered into the cafeteria on day one of kink camp, the first time I went, and it was just like 10 minutes of wooing. It was just people being like, ah, you know, just like, we are away. We are away from the restraints of society, and we're free. We're free. And going from the euphoria of that to within, you know, like a half a day or so of being like, oh, but I'm the freak among the freaks. Right. I still don't belong.
Those old habits die hard, you know.
They do.
Yeah.
When you talked about it being like another realm, the dark room, the back room experience, like, that was always so profound.
Yeah.
The male energy, like this sort, there was always something incredibly primal about it that really felt like, oh shit, we've been doing this since we were cavemen, you know, like
a room circles, full of jaguars.
Yes, circles of dudes, like, right. Like
100%.
Getting off with one another, like, this goes way back. And that's a phenomena and an experience that a lot of people just will never really understand or experience, and I really treasured that, you know, that feeling of wow.
Right.
I started to very much feel like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Right.
You know, that sort of thing, like, where there was my good boy out in the world persona. And then once you cross those doors, you were in the other realm.
Different world.
It's funny that at my age, I very rarely go to those kind of places anymore. And one of the reasons is that, especially with how kinky I've become and how important it is to me to be able to talk to people. You know what I mean? Like, you and I were just saying the whole "you okay" thing, the one-on-one experience. I mean, I was so thrilled about Grindr when it came out because I was like, oh, I'm a writer.
Right.
Now, I don't have to look hot across the room.
I can seduce with my words.
Like Cyrano de Bergerac, yeah.
I know this feeling.
So now I don't go as often, and I think that a lot of those sorts of spaces would not be as magical to me as back in the day, because, yeah, I do, like, so value being in, like, a private space with someone and just kind of building a little intimacy together. Yeah.
And now they say that, like, the kind of group sexual energy is everywhere in New York. Like, it's not, it doesn't, like, call a siren song to me, but, you know, just the exuberance of these male spaces or people who identify as men or non-binary, you know, having sex in joyous, huge ways. There was some article a few months ago, like, has New York hit peak gay sluttiness? Peak.
Oh, I'm a writer.
Right.
Yes, circles of dudes like getting off with one another. Like, this goes way back. Right. And this guy really loves butts, but doesn't use his dick to fuck.
Right.
I don't fuck with my dick.
Right.
Not interested in fucking.
Sluttiness.
That hasn't occurred to me as like the thing I want to do to the butt. Do to the butt.
News I can use. Having sex.
Always obsessed with boys' butts and just like, you know, how I wanted to stick my face in there and stick my fingers in there and all this stuff. So
his dick was hard.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Sex.
Yes. And that's that. David Zelnick's solo play, Oh Time, is on May 26th at Ensemble Studio Theater in New York. And you can listen to his 9-episode young adult musical podcast, Loveville High, wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find him on Instagram at David Zelnick. Folks, my latest online storytelling workshop still has a slot free. So if you want to jump in a little late, many have done so before. And or if you'd just like to get news in the ongoing future about my next storytelling workshops, just email me at kevin@risk-show.com. And if you want to help support Risk, which is very expensive to operate and regularly struggles to break even, consider joining our Patreon at patreon.com/risk, where there's so many more stories and check-ins. One of our Patreon patrons, Stephanie, sent us this note with their donation. Thank you for making me kinder, as well as some snort laughs. And another named David wrote, I really appreciate the podcast. It's helped carry me through some hard times. Thank you, Stephanie and David. We couldn't continue to do it without the financial support of our listeners. So anyone can join us or increase the amount of their donation at patreon.com/risk. And if you want to make a one-time donation, that's at paypal.me/riskshow. Also, we had a great conversation pop up over at the Risk Podcast Fans Discussion Group on Facebook this week. People chiming in about the first ever story they remember hearing on Risk. So check that out if you can. And if you've got a story about trying something you were scared to try at first, like David in the Dark Room, just go to risk-show.com/submissions and send us your pitch. Because, folks, today's the day. Take a risk.
Children's bedrooms. Has the synthetic scourge made its way into your very home? Make no mistake, Patriot. The enemy is here, and it wants to replace your soul with a sequence of ones and zeros. But we here at Risk will not go down quietly. Some of our best editors have been seen talking to their toasters and dancing to the music of AI musicians. And we did not hesitate in killing them on the spot. We want to be wet with the blood, sweat, and tears of real musicians. Liquid reminders that we are still flesh and bone, and we like to be dripping with the various effluvia of our friends. On the episode you just heard, you too found yourself saturated with the proof of life of two such leaky, fearless heroes of this cyber war. Patriots Rafter and Kid 14 answered the call and took their bugles up to invigorate and steel us for this fight, and they died in this noble cause. Truly, they are both dead now. So hard did they play these songs. Their sacrifices keep the darkness at bay for now, and their vibrations will ring out into eternity. Find the legacy Kid 14 left behind at kid14.com and kid14.bandcamp.com. Purchases of his music will go towards funeral rites and fulfillment of his noble legacy. Find Rafter's music at rafter.bandcamp.com. Purchases of his music will go to settling outstanding debts he accrued in life at various obscure OnlyFans sites, whose proprietors will greatly appreciate their fulfillment. But the fight rages on. We need you to contribute your creative efforts in this struggle against warehouses upon warehouses of cold circuitry, which conspire to impress us and trick us into wiggling our booties and grooving enthusiastically. As we all know, if we knew it was AI music we were hearing, we would cross our arms and frown disapprovingly. Send us your human music and keep our airwaves human. Send your submissions to kevin@risk-show.com with "Down with Slow Death" in the subject line. And keep us from wondering if the music we're listening to is actually brilliant, or if we were just tricked into thinking so. Onward!